And I'm going to call him, I'm tired of seeing the screen. So it's going to be an example of the applications of techniques and results from the theory of the classification theory. For the purpose of studying the structure of certain systems, which was introduced some of the measures several decades ago. And so this is what I want to describe. So first I'm going to define certain system variables. Okay, so yeah, okay, it's good to have this thing because then I can see what it is I'm supposed to say. So I should start by saying that this is based on a preprint which you can download from this address on the internet. And then on top of that, much of what I'm going to say is based on a well, there are more recent results, so it's a paper which is in preparation with all that implies. Okay, so, sorry? I mean, the first paper you can find, that's the preprint server of the Institute. The other one is still in a file which I'm working on. I hope to have it ready before Christmas. Okay, in any case, so the input from the topological dynamic system side is something which is called an expansive homeomorphism. So we're considering a compact metric space. This is just the definition of expansiveness. So if you have a compact metric space and you have a homeomorphism, it's called expansive if it has this property that there is some positive number such that if two points in the space are different, then eventually on some place in the orbit they'll have this distance at least. So that's the definition of expansiveness. So this is all the systems that I'm going to consider are going to be expansive. So. This definition, of course, you can do in arbitrary dynamical systems. You can define this equivalence relations among points in the underlying space, which declare two points to be homoclinic if they asymptotically agree both in the future and in the past. So that's what I call the two points are homoclinic. And then I define that a slightly stronger notion. Namely, strongly, I say the two points are strongly homoclinic if, roughly speaking, you have this homoclinicity happening uniformly in a neighborhood. So that's, I believe this is introduced implicitly in the work of David Ruel, who somehow started this. And it's clear, of course, that with this definition, strong homoclinicity implies homoclinicity, but in general the implication the other way does not hold true, but for all the dynamic systems that I'm going to talk about here, which are all going to be smell spaces, the two things are equivalent. Okay, so that's if you have an expansive homeomorphism, you can use this equivalence relation to consider the graph of the equivalence relation, and you can give that a topology by using these local conjugacies. And it turns out then that this is actually, this is what is called an entalogy relation. I'm not going to define that. I mean, many of you probably know what it is, and those of you who don't, probably won't be happy if I give the definition anyway. I mean, the main point here is that because of this property, that it's a talent equivalence relation, with this topology given by this space as indicated, you can define a starboard, you can give the continuous functions on R that vanish at infinity, that are compactly supported. You can give those a structure of a star algebra by these two formulas, the product and then the involution, and then there's a canonical way of completing that to a Caesar algebra. So this is a construction which, I don't know, maybe it's Alan Connor, maybe it's Jean Renaud, but it's relatively old. And if you do this with this equivalence relation coming from the homoclinicity of an expansive dynamical system, And if the dynamical system is what's called a smell stage, you get what is called the acetotic amnesia. I mean, I believe it was Ian Putnam who invented that phrase. The original definition in that setting is due to David Well. So the next thing I want to do is to introduce what I call the heteroclinic algebra, which corresponds to what Ian Putnam calls the stable algebra. My construction is different, but so it goes like this. I mean, you don't consider all points in the space to define the heteroclinic algebra. You only consider the points that are what I call post-periodic, which means that, you know, you can see the definition. I mean, far away in the past, they were periodic. So they somehow come out of periodic orbits. So these are what I call post-periodic points. Okay, so the set of post-periodic points is going to be given a topology, which I call the Wagner topology, because, I mean, I think that he was the first to consider this topology in the setting of countable state Markov chains. But here this is because I'm just throwing a base for this topology to you. I mean, so for any, you have a post-periodic point, there's a small epsilon, such that all of these sets here, no matter what k is, and no matter which epsilon you take, smaller than epsilon x, then this is going to be an open set, and together they form a base of the topology. So that's...
It would be some J's in this formula, I suppose.
Sorry?
In this formula, I would prefer to see twice the J and twice and not...
Oh, like yeah, okay, so that's right. True. That's apparently, of course, I picked the wrong file. It should be a K here, right? So that's what you mean, right?
Or a J. Because there's another J in this definition.
All right. Exactly, it should be a J both places. Thank you. Both should be J.
Zero is actually the closed set or the open set?
No, well, I mean, in X it's neither. I mean, it's an open set in the public topology. I mean, I don't know. It has no nice description in terms of the topology of X. So W doesn't have the relative, it's a subset of X, of course, but it doesn't have the relative topology. It has this topology for which these sets with a J here, I apologize for that, is the base. Well, I mean, these are just, I mean, you fix an X, right, for each given X, and it really only depends on this epsilon X, really only depends on which periodic point to which it is post-periodic. But that's not important here. So, but for any X, you have this epsilon X. And then, so, see what I mean? Despite the misprint. Okay. Right, and so what you do exactly as you did before with the whole space X, but now you only do it for the post-periodic points. You declare two points to be strongly heteroclinic if they, I mean, their orbits approach each other as you iterate the map, but you do it again such that this approaching thing happens uniformly in an open neighborhood. So, and again, I should say that if the dynamical system is a Snell space, as it will be shortly, then this strong heteroclinicity would be equivalent to ordinary heteroclinicity. And so the point is that in this, I mean, so the orbits, at least that I think of it, I mean, you have some periodic point here, and then you have the orbit coming out here, and then the other point here comes out of possibly another periodic orbit here, and then they approach each other when you go to the future. I mean, this is our picture of, of two points. Well, this is an orbit of a point, this is an orbit of another point, and this is a picture of what it means that they are, say, strongly located. Okay. And then, so it's a fact that that you can, you just take the equivalence relation again and give it the same kind of topology. Now, of course, you're using the local conjugacies coming only from open section W, the Wagner topology, and that gives you an entire equivalence relation in the same way as it did for the homogenic equivalence relations. And you can define the C squared in the same way by this method of Chiavano. Okay, and so for Smale spaces, this algebra that you get out is daily isomorphic to what Ian Putnam introduced as the stable algebra.
But these are not stable algebras? I mean, is that something stable under tension of the compact topic?
For Smale spaces, this algebra, the heteroclinic algebra of the mixing Smale space is always stable. I'm not sure if that's true for what Ian calls the stable algebra, but it's true for the heteroclinic algebra. If it's true for Ian's algebras also, then the two algebras will simply be isomorphic. Okay, so I decided now to talk about some specific examples of these dynamical systems, namely so-called generalized one solenoids. And so the next thing I'm going to do is to describe these dynamical systems for you. And so the input for this is a finite unoriented graph, so that would be the capital gamma here. And you take a continuous map, mapping that graph to itself, and then there's the wrong way. And then certain conditions must be satisfied. So the first condition is what's called expansion. So it means that you have this, there should be some constant. So basically what it means is that the map should expand if you map two points which are on an edge, so that the image is also in an edge, and so that the interval between them lie in the edge. So it's not a global expansiveness here, that's important to realize. But you have it under these additional conditions that you have two points x and y that are on the same edge, and such that the interval, so this is going to be the interval between the two points in this edge, and the image under h of m should be contained in the same edge again. And under these assumptions, then you should have this equality here.
Do edges have different lengths or length one?
Sorry?
The edges, do they have the same length all the time? Or?
Well, I mean, with this formulation, I mean, this is independent of the metric, really. I mean, it should, but as long as they're equivalent. So, I mean, if you want, you can take a metric so that the edges have length 1, if you prefer.
Well, the right-hand side might get big if lambda gets big, unless x and y are supposed to be close also. So the right-hand side might be bigger than 1, for instance, and then it's hard to fit the point into an edge.
Yeah, but then the condition is vacuous since the interval from one part to the other is not the small edge.
I'll give you an example.
So they get farther apart until they run, one of them runs off the edge, and then there's no condition anymore.
Okay. So and then the next condition is non-folding, which means, as you can see, it just means that any power of h should be locally injected on each edge. And so there's a Markov condition, which says that h should map vertices to vertices. And there's a mixing condition, namely that the image of any, I mean, you iterate the map on each edge, eventually to blow up and cover the whole graph. And I said, well, I'll teach you. And then there's an important flattening condition also, namely that the image, I mean, each point in the graph, there should be an open neighborhood. There should be a D, fixed D, such that for any point in the graph and for each open neighborhood, there should be an open neighborhood such that the image is simply an open interval. Okay, so these are all the definitions. And so let me give you an example of of, with the supplies for this four exits. So the graph that I'm thinking of here is just have one vertex.
Because I hope you're going to leave these definitions on the room.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, okay, I didn't understand that. Okay, so this is one edge, and this is another one. So this is the kind of graph that I'm considering. So, I mean, no fancy graphs here. The graph is completely ridiculous in this sense. So, but what I want to do is to describe for you a map H on this graph, which is the graph to itself. And for that purpose, I choose an orientation. I emphasize that it's just for the purpose of describing the map. So I choose some orientation of the H, shaped like this. Okay. And then I divide this H like this. Then I write E. Okay, maybe I should say then this edge I call E and this I call F, or one or two if you prefer, but I've chosen E and F. So then I write E here. By this I mean that as the variable here moves in the direction of the arrow from here out, it should go all the way around the edge E. So then maybe say with triple speed if you want. So this is how A should act on this piece. And then on the next piece, it should be F, which means that, I mean, when you get there, you're back at the vertex. And so with F, I mean, you just go follow the arrow around in the direction indicated by the arrow. So this is how the map is acting here. So here I write E to the minus first, by which I mean that when you get here, you're back at the vertex, so here, as you probably already guessed, you take the edge E again, but in the opposite direction of the arrow. Okay, so this is, and then you write an F here, and you write an E here, and you take F to the minus third here. Of course, you can interpret what I mean by this in the same way. So this is going to be an example of a map that satisfies all these conditions.
It doesn't look locally injective.
Well, locally injective, and only on the edges, you know.
Yeah, but if I just edge up there, then I think to run through E once this way and then back, so I see it point twice.
It is locally injective. Clearly locally injective.
How does the flattening work at the vertex? Yeah, that's what I want to worry about. It's flattening at the vertex.
It is flattening. Because the image, if you take the neighborhood here, what you get is this piece here, and this piece there, which is, you know, a copy of the interval.
Okay.
You can write all of the many things down here. The only things that you have to worry, I mean, the Markov condition, it will be trivial, but it's the non-folding condition and the flattening condition that you are going to. Well, the mixing condition is, of course, you also have to worry about, but that's easy to have satisfied. So in any case, these are the definitions. They go back to Williams, Bob Williams, as it was called. And then they have been started by, this definition in this form goes back to Yi, who used them also to study the Cisco and the rest. In any case, so once you have all these axioms, those that you have here, what you do is to form the inverse limit space, or you have a dynamical system which is not invertible. You have this graph and then you have this continuous map, and you form what is called the natural invertible extension. The definition here, you just take the projective limit, if you want to call it that, where the connected maps are just H all the time.
Yes, sir. So I just thought this flattening thing again. So this is exactly, so, I mean, you take any two words in the free group or something like this, and you can right down something like this, but mostly it won't be flattening.
No, right, no, but I mean, many times it will, but you're right. I mean, if you just do it carelessly, then it typically will not be flat.
The fact that you've got E and E inverse, and half inverse is what made it look
like. Okay, so, but, and so maybe I should say that again. So the flattening condition is a severe restriction, actually. And if you omit that, if you omit the flattening condition, you'll still get a mixing expansive dynamical systems. The flattening condition is exactly what makes it a Smale space. So the Smale, so it's one way of seeing that the Smale space assumption is not at all innocent. It's really a severe restriction. But it's due to the flattening condition. Okay, so you do this, I mean, you take the inverse limit space here, and then you just extend the map H coordinate wise. So in the inverse limit space, that'll actually be a homeomorphism where the inverse would be the shift. Okay. And so then it's a theorem, which most of it at least is just due to Yi, namely that you do get an expansive homeomorphism in this case, and it is mixing, and it is Smale space, thanks to the flattening condition. Okay.
The inverse doesn't look like a, it's a one-sided shift, and that's not the only one,
isn't it? It is, if you think about it. Okay. So the point is, what I want to do now is to describe my results on the structure of the C-square that you get out of this. I mean, so you have what I call the homoclinic algebra, which corresponds to Ian's asymptotic algebra, and you have the heteroclinic algebra, which corresponds to the stable algebra of Ian, and you also have the heteroclinic algebra for the inverse, which corresponds to Ian's unstable algebra. Okay, and so the result about the heteroclinic algebra of the inverse is the following, namely that it's the heteroclinic algebra of the inverse is the stabilization of a cross product by a minimal homeomorphism on the Cantor set. And this was true for by Yi for the case where H is orientation preserving. Meaning that this example here is not orientation preserving, because clearly some of the maps defined so that at certain points it reverses the orientation. Okay, but in any case, that's the case, and it's not completely arbitrary, this minimal homeomorphism, as you may know, there are actually quite a lot of them, but it's either an odometer or primitive substitution shift, which means that if you write down this Bradley-Berschek model for minimal homeomorphisms, then it's a stationary system which corresponds exactly to the fact that it's either an odometer or a primitive substitution. Okay, so in particular, the algebra is a simple AT algebra of real rank 0, and there's an essentially unique lower semi-continuous density defined trace. The K1 group is the integers always, and the K0 group is this stationary dimension group.
But this is essentially unique
group? Up to scalar multiplication.
Oh, okay.
So, and there's a lot of names to this. I mean, my contribution here is to remove the assumption about the map being orientation preserving here. And the proof is completely different from Yi's, actually. But part of it is at least due to Yi, and it uses the work of Herman and Putnam and Scout and Terry Giordano and probably others also. So, that's the story as far as the unstable algebra approach. So now the main theorem, so our, and well, in any case, the story about the heteroclinic algebra of the generalized one solenoid is that it is a simple AH algebra of real rank 0. It can be realized, if you want, as a sequence of finite direct sums of circle algebras and dimensions of algebras. So I don't know if that's what's called an AD algebra at some point. In any case, that's one way of realizing it. Again, it has an essentially unique lower semi-continuous densely defined trace. in the same sense as before. And then there's this funny dichotomy in the K1 group. I mean, for the first part, of the theorem was a huge disappointment to me, because I was hoping that these algebras were going to have, say, real rank 1 or something like that. But it turned out that they did not have. But this was a surprise to me that there was this dichotomy in the K1 group. And the K1 group is either the integers, and if it's not, then it's set mod 2. And it turns out that this depends exactly not on whether or not H is orientation preserving, but whether or not H squared or H composition. It's simply a question of whether H composition itself twice is orientation preserving or not.
Could you go back one slide? What was the algebras of the theorem? I don't know what point BH inverse of gamma phi. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry?
All right, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So that's the short story of the heterophonic algebra. And then the homoclinic algebra. The homoclinic algebra is the generalized one solenoid. It's a simple unital AH algebra, real rank 0, with no dimension group and a unique trace state. These algebras, the asymptotic algebra, or the homoclinic algebra, as I call it, is unital. All these, as soon as you have a mixing smith space, in any case, the algebra is going to be simple. So it's the inductive limit decomposition which is new here. Okay. The point I want to emphasize here that actually for this example here, the K1 group of the homoclinic group will have two torsion, both in K0 and in K1. So it means that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it means that you need three-dimensional spaces to realize it as an AH. Okay, so let me say something about the proofs. I mean, I'm just going to give a crude outline of the idea of the proof of this. I mean, first of all, I want to handle the homoclinic algebra, the point is that you can use a theorem of Ian Fortman on the homoclinic algebra, which says, in his terminology, it says that the asymptotic algebra is stably isomorphic to the tensor product of the stable and the unstable algebra. So I formulated that in my notation here. So that's the point. So it means, of course, that if you want to understand the structure of the homoclinic algebra, I mean, your idea is to study the structure of the heteroclinic algebra and the heteroclinic algebra of the inverse. So and that's the strategy that I've been following. So again, I now say that this should be an A here, and I actually corrected that in another file. It's a spelling mistake. Yeah, right. Okay, so what I want to do here is to focus on the heteroclinic algebra, because that's that was the most persistent one. So the first observation is as I said, I mean, this map H on the graph is not expansive globally, but I have only introduced expansiveness for homeomorphisms, but for continuous maps, there's a notion of positive expansiveness, which is defined in a similar way. And the point is that the map H does not have this property, but it has it with a sort of delay, which implies that if two points in this solenoid are forward asymptotic under H bar, then the image of the first coordinate will have to agree eventually for some k. So, and this is very special. That's why I wanted to start here. And this is really why I can get anywhere with these financial systems and not, say, general snake spaces. And then the second observation is just that at least as long as you're away from the vertices, if you have an equality on like this, then you can extend it to a neighborhood because of the flattening condition. So, and if you keep that in mind, then this explains why I introduced the next notion on this slide, namely what I call open interval ground relation, where you consider a closed interval and a continuous locally injected map on the interval into a graph. So this gamma is a graph again. So when you just define an equivalence relation on the open interval, such that two points are equivalent if and only if, well, you can see the condition there, namely that there should be an open neighborhood of each of them so that the image on the G is simply the same and homeomorphic to the interval. So it's a fact that this is one instance where you can just take the relative topology from the product, and that'll actually give you an entire equivalence relation. That's very rare. When you have an equivalence relation and you write down the graph, that if you just take the relative topology from the product, then typically it will never be, typically it will not be a tell, but it will in this case. And it's not difficult to see that the corresponding group or existential algebra is subhomogeneous with a one-dimensional spectrum. So if you use this, if you remember the two properties that I pointed out, it actually means, well, you have to argue here, of course, but the point is, it turns out that you can use these observations to prove that the heterokinetic algebra is an inductive limit of group or existential algebras corresponding to open interval graph relations. So it means that once you have this, it means that you immediately know that this algebra is an A-S-H algebra. It's an approximately subhomogeneous algebra. And so I've written down a question here. We don't know much about those in general, and it's not only meant to be a rhetoric question. I really don't know exactly what is known about these. But in any case,
Well, this one's a recursive homogeneous algebra.
Yeah, they are.
So, and there's a bounded dimension growth, so something is known anyway.
Yeah. Is still out there, so. But you need something like set stability or something like that.
Well, it's all been proved.
Well. Okay, so in any case. So, okay, so what I want to do is to describe a better inductive limit decomposition, which is easier to work with, actually. But it comes out by looking at what these open interval graph relation algebras look like. So now I'm going to tell you what they look like after some work. What you get is actually the algebras of the form that Søren Eilers discussed. So take two natural numbers and n and m, and take two n times m matrices with entries from 0, 1. And so, with this condition here, so there should be a lot of zeros and then a few ones. That's the, and so if you have that, that should be for every k, yes. And so, take two tuples of natural numbers so that of course, you define, these are matrix algebras, of course, so this is the finite dimensional algebra corresponding to this tuple, and this is a finite dimensional algebra corresponding to the other one. And if you assume this name and you have this condition holding here, then what you get are unital, you get two unital homomorphisms from f of a into f of b with these matrices as multiplicity matrices. And then you can define this algebra here, which is exactly one of the type that Søren was discussing. And it turns out these are actually the building blocks here. So what turns out to be the case is that the heterokinetic algebra is is stabilized algebra of a unital C2 algebra, which can be realized as an inductive limit of unital C2 algebra to unital connecting maps, where notice here the importance here is that the two matrices U and I are fixed. They don't vary. I mean, the sizes, as you can imagine, of A and B, and the numbers increase, of course. But the sizes of the tuples, the number of direct summons in the finite dimension algebra stay fixed, and the multiplicity map stays fixed also. So this is somehow in a sense a stationary system here, and actually it's the connecting maps are also stationary in some sense, namely in the sense that they're actually locating this system. Okay, and then the hard part of the proof is to show that, and this is that this inductive limit system that you get out of there actually has real rank zero. And that of course only follows by looking closely to what the connecting maps look like.
Yeah, there's a general theorem about real rank zero for great limits of recursive sum of units is calculus.
Yeah.
If the map from A0 to the affine functions on the trivial state space has dense range, and then under the conditions of which are satisfied for your algebra, then the algebra is real rank zero.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, but that's not the way I prove it. The way that I proved it is to show that any self-adjoint element here can be approximated by a self-adjoint finite spectrum. That's the definition.
I think that U and I grow together.
Sorry?
U and I, the matrices, I think they both grow together.
Okay, how do I get at them from gamma? Actually, they come out. Okay, so let us take this example. Let us take this example there. So what I do is to look at one of the edges, say E. So E under when you take the image of E under H, what you get is E F E inverse. And then you use H again. So E goes to E F E inverse again. So that was this E here. The F here, I can't remember what was it.
F inverse.
And E inverse, so that's the inverse of this, so it's E F inverse E. And I think maybe this is already enough. Otherwise, the point is you have to, of course you can repeat this then. I mean you can apply H again and you look at what you get. So it's a substitution game here, you substitute this thing for E and so on. What you have to continue this until you have the number of the passages, what I call passages. So you have a passage here, E, F. So this is this passage. And then you have a passage, F, E, inverse. So this is how I think of it. So this is a passage. Then you have this passage here. I indicate that by, I hope you see the idea that F goes in that direction and E comes from the other side. And that's what I am. So, and then you have E inverse, so that would be E, and then F, and then so, and then you have F. So this is actually not the same as this one, but this will be enough actually in this case. So you don't get any more. The point is you can iterate H again, and so this is so. In this case, it means that the M will be 4. The M will be 4, and N, by the way, N is always the number of edges. So in this case, it'll be 2. And so what you do here, for instance, so the matrix is a matrix which is where the rows are numbered by the edges, and the columns by this, what I call passages. And so this thing here, this should correspond to a column, right? And this column, so how is it? Yeah. So here F is what I call an entry edge, because in this passage you go into F, and in this passage you go out of E. So it means that to the E matrix here, if you, let's say that this is the first column. So the E matrix, it should have, so let's say that E corresponds to the first row, so it should have a zero here, but a one here for S, because it's an entry to S. And so when you fill out for the other rows also, so U at this point here should be one here, because it's an exit from E, and there should be zero here, because it's not an exit from F. So this is how the matrices come up. Okay. Do I have more to say? Yes, of course. So this is, of course, I don't know, in order to prove that it has real rank zero, I used the definition, as I told you. I didn't use this theorem that Chris is referring to. But the point is, once you have that the algebra has real rank zero, you are in immediate connection with the result from the classification theory. Because then you can show that the algebra has what is a tracial rank zero as defined by Hwaksin Lin. I mean, you have certain conditions, I can't remember, but in any case, the only thing you really, I mean, I'm thinking about a theorem where you have that, I mean, traces should be AC and it should have real rank zero and what is it else? I mean, there should not be too many extreme traces, right? Right, okay, so the only point is that if you look again at the stationary sequence, it's not difficult to show, it's much easier than proving we rank zero, really, that there's only one trace. So that's okay. And then so once you have trace of rank zero, you're in good shape, and then you can follow from, I don't know, four sides, I suppose. But it strongly uses Lin's theorem. And actually also in order to prove real rank zero, I thought for a long time actually that I could do that just using, you know, eigenvalue crossovers as George did in relation to AD algebras and circle algebras. But I mean, as it turned out, I wasn't able to do it without using Lin's theorem. So certain approximations have to be made regardless of the dimension, so I use Lin's theorem on almost normal matrices. But of course, in order to come from Lin's work to A-H algebras, I certainly use results of Elliott, Gong, and Lee, and Chris Phillips also. But once you have real rank zero in this setup at least, then everything is easy, thanks to this work.
You couldn't just prove it was a valid dimension, AH, and then in the AH classification, you get the 0 and 0 the trace. But maybe it's hard to prove that it's a valid dimension.
Well, I don't know, but it's a valid dimension, AFH.
Oh, yes, it's all right.
And unique tracial states.
Yeah.
And so then that doesn't imply real rank zero.
But
if the range of the map from K0 to the reals defined by the tracial states is dense in the reals, that implies real rank zero and in fact tracial rank.
I hear what you're saying, but I never thought about proving it that way.
But I'm not quite sure how you could use my theorem with the Green Bond and Nanjing.
Well, that was explained to me by Chris Phillips in his paper on the non-commutative toroid.
Okay.
He has a nice proposition there where he explains how to get from Lin's results to U.S.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that'll be all. I'm out of time.
Very much so,
yes. It is. It appears so, I mean, but it will, I mean, it will still be, I mean, would be, I mean, what Chris is saying is that if you can show that you know, how is it? I mean, if you look at all the maps, the affine maps on the trace space, you get from projections. If this is dense in the affine functions, right, that would be, I mean, if that is true, then you have real rank zero for free, given that it's, I suppose, it's a simple ASH
with no dimension growth.
With no dimension growth, yeah. So, but I mean, that is not going to be easy to prove, say, for your tiling space. Well, I mean, you could try. I never tried that approach. It never occurred to me.
I think, you know, I was wondering if you get dynamic systems that are small spaces.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but if you omit the flattening condition, I mean, that's really, I mean, but it seems to be, I mean, it seems that
the flattening condition guarantees that.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, that in this setup, I mean, this is, I just want to make one advertisement for having this theory without the Smale space assumption, namely that if you do that, I mean, you can make the definition without the flattening condition. And the point is that what you get for the heteroclinic algebra is not going to be simple. So that implies actually for the dynamic system is still going to be mixing and expansive. But then you can, using only operator algebra results, you can conclude that in that setup, the Smale space structure, which you know is relatively complicated, I mean, just give me at least 5 minutes to write the definition down, it exists if and only if you have the flattening condition. I see no way of proving that directly.
Charlie, any questions?
I'm wondering what you mean, but the space you have as one big